From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when college students came back to school from break. Two seniors, specifically, returning to Nazareth University. But this time, a little bit of a different scenario. These students were going to live at St. John's Meadows in Brighton as part of the university's gerontology program. They're doing so as part of an independent study project called Student in Residence. Students live at the independent senior living facility. They would dine with the residents, perhaps build relationships. And it's a real chance to improve their studies by actually working and living among people that they might work with, not just sitting in a classroom. So a growing number of Americans, this is all happening when a growing number of Americans report feeling more lonely or isolated. Now, interestingly, at least to me, the most lonely group is the youngest group of adults in this country, age 18 to 30. Americans over the age of 65 report being the least lonely Americans, but all age groups have seen their reported loneliness and isolation increase in recent years, despite more opportunities to connect than ever before with various forms of technology. And speaking of technology, technology can change culture pretty quickly. We talked about it last hour. We've been talking about it a lot lately. And when it does, it can feel isolating if perhaps you grew up at a time when things are quite different. And so that's another layer or another barrier for a lot of people. Here's another interesting piece of data. Americans are seeing less of each other in person than we have in a long time. A number of surveys in the past year indicate that we are spending more time alone, less time socializing in all age groups. So let's talk this hour about this Students in Residence program and what the aims are, and frankly, what it means to spend more time together sort of across generations and boundaries. And I think it's a great opportunity to get to know one another better. Let me welcome our guests. Dr. David Steitz is with us. Professor Steitz is a professor of psychology and director of Nazareth University's gerontology program. Thank you for being here.
Evan, thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Also, welcome to Ken Dodgson, who is a resident at Brickstone, and we're going to be talking about Ken's experience as well. It's nice to have you, sir. Thank you for making time.
Well, thank you for letting us come.
Absolutely. Great to have you. Great to have Tony Zaccolino, who is Vice President of Senior Housing at St. John's. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Welcome for the invite.
And Sarah Dodona is with us, and Sarah is on the line with us, who is a senior at Nazareth University. Sarah, welcome. Thank you for taking time as well for the program.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to start with Dr. Steitz here. So I did my best to kind of describe what's going on, but I want to give you some space to talk about exactly what the mission here is and how this has all come together.
So we've been very fortunate to be partnering, collaborating with St. John's for 14 years now. I did my graduate work at Syracuse, and I'd be in a classroom trying to talk about growing old to a room full of 150 undergraduates. And here I am, 30 or something year old, talking about this. And when I got to Nazareth, I was fortunate to be able to form this partnership back in 2009. So I realized really the best way for my students to learn professionally and personally about themselves, about aging, is to be in a room with older adults. So every Tuesday night for the last 14 years, St. John's has welcomed us from Nazareth. We've had a number of elder residents in our classes, and we've all been learning with and from one another since 09. It's been a great experience.
And, you know, in order to have this partnership work, you have to have, obviously, students who want to do this, but you also have to have people like Ken and many others. And what has the reception been like?
We're very fortunate to have people like Ken who've been with us. He's been in our classes now, I think, 11 years. Always just wanting to share their insights and their experiences. Our classes are about learning sort of the facts about aging, learning how to best train students in physical therapy and occupational therapy to work with older adults in terms of the knowledge base they need. But these classes are really just so much more about the personal connections that they make with the elders and learn just the personal sides of growing old, the humanistic perspectives of it.
You know, David, there's a number of things that you could learn in a classroom. And, you know, you might be able to learn about physical therapy, occupational therapy, and in that kind of a setting. What are some of the insights that you have observed, perhaps students gaining, or, you know, maybe some of the relationships built that you don't think would have been possible if not for this kind of a program?
Just perspectives on life, to slow down, to reflect for a little bit, to think about what you have relative to what other people have, to think about the access to health care, for example, that you've taken for granted for your entire life, and to think about other people in the community that might not have that, and to get those perspectives from older adults in terms of the successes that they've had in life, even the failures that they've had in life, and how they've learned and how they've grown from those. Those are the sorts of things you're not going to get in a textbook, and you're not going to get from me if I just thought I had all the right answers, if I thought I knew everything that they needed to know. I realized early on I didn't know that. It was actually that first class, of funny story, first class in fall of 09, I still remember the very last day, four of the elders came up to me and said, "All right, David, we'll be back in the spring, but we have a say in what we do. We're never going to use that textbook again. I thought I knew what the issues in aging were. I thought I knew what was important, and they informed me that I didn't." And so ever since then, these courses every semester are a collaboration where we work with the elders, we do focus groups, we talk about what's relevant and important to them, what do they think our students need to know, and we find a good sort of synthesis of what they want to focus on, but also the content that students need to make sure they acquire as part of their education.
So let's talk to some of the people involved here. And Sarah is on the line with us, a senior at Nazareth. And tell us what I guess the last 3 weeks or so have been like for you, Sarah.
Honestly, they've been a complete different experience for me. I never expected to have such a good time in a senior living facility. I thought it was going to be nervous. I thought I was going to be nervous and it was going to be kind of weird, but I jumped right in. Everybody at St. John's made me feel so comfortable and welcome there. I was always active and doing something. There's always something to going on at St. John's. An activity or just kind of sitting and talking with everybody. It was definitely a great experience for me.
What is your field of study, and tell us about what you're working on, Sarah?
So I am a psychology major with a minor in gerontology and social work. In this semester, I've been focusing on a project that kind of goes around dementia patients. And although St. John's Meadows is a independent senior facility, I was actually able to talk to a lot of caregivers whose loved ones have dementia. And I also participated in the dementia resources over at St. John's Home, which was a great experience. And I learned so much about dementia patients along with caregivers and kind of their quality of life, especially being not at their own home, but in a facility like this.
When you say that, you know, at first you had some apprehension, you thought it might be, you know, a little weird, and take me through a little bit of what you expected and when you started to realize that apprehension, you know, was not necessary.
So at first I kind of expected that the residents were going to kind of see us as more of like staffing. they weren't going to see us as part of like their everyday lives. But just after the first meal, being down in the cafe, everybody was asking us, you know, "Oh, you guys are the Nazareth girls. You guys are here to stay with us for 3 weeks. Like, are you going to come to this event? Are you going to come and do this exercise with us?" Like, it just, like, as soon as that conversation sparked up, I knew that I was going to be comfortable here and that I was going to feel welcomed and involved in everything.
So what has there been an average day? What's an average day been like for the last 3 weeks?
So like an average day for me, I had a pretty flexible schedule involving like my classes at Nazareth. So I was actually able to spend a lot of time with the residents at St. John's. So my favorite activity involved the pool. I did water aerobics and water volleyball on Wednesday and Thursdays. Those were my favorite activities to get involved with. So my average day was waking up. I usually did my classes in the morning. And then around noon, I would come back to St. John's and I would just kind of jump into all the activities. I would go to my water aerobics and water volleyball, which usually lasted for about an hour. And then after that, I would just spend some time with the residents, kind of chit-chatting with each other. And then usually I would head down to the dining room where my other former student would join me for dinner. So,
true or false, the residents, some of the senior water volleyball players are very into their game.
Yes, they are very into their game. I was actually very surprised to see how competitive they were. I thought it was going to be just like a mellow volleyball game, but we were rocking and rolling. We were, it was very, very tiring in my opinion.
Sarah, let me also ask you about the value of these 3 weeks in building real relationships that will help you in your work, but also go beyond sort of the idea of just studying each other. Like my dad likes to joke that, you know, when he spends time with younger people now, he's like studying a different species sometimes. You know, like, I mean, it's just, you know, the way we communicate is different. The way we use technology is often different. But how did you work to not only kind of, yes, learn and study, et cetera, but also kind of break down defenses and just kind of spend authentic time, if that makes sense?
Yeah, so I've actually had a really strong relationship with my grandma since I was a little girl. So I've kind of always had that sense of connection with the older population and how to kind of talk with them. But as far as St. John's residents, all of them were mostly pretty easygoing talking to. I spent a lot of time with a specific resident who was actually a caregiver for her husband. Yes, we talked a lot about my project and schooling, but we would get off track and kind of just talk about like what she would do when she was a teacher for students with disabilities. And, you know, I was just kind of talking to her about how the times have changed in how we approach students with disabilities. And it was just kind of amusing to her to hear about how those have changed in the years and how we, I guess our language has changed a lot.
Yeah. And then Sarah actually kind of living for 3 weeks in this setting, instead of just visiting or having a half hour lunch or whatever, you're observing the differences in the rhythms of life and some of the customs that different generations would have. That's going to be true as well. There will be a time where your generation is viewed as, you know, not current with certain technology or, you know, and that's kind of what happens all the time. I am curious to know what you observe to be maybe either the most surprising or the biggest difference in sort of daily norms, or even if there was something that you appreciated that you took away personally from these interactions.
So in my opinion, I think that my generation is so fast paced. I think that we are constantly going 100 miles per hour, doing this and that and everything. During my 3 weeks, it just like everything slowed down. I felt like I could spend an hour just sitting and enjoying a meal and having a conversation without feeling like I needed to, you know, like rush through a meal to go and do this or go and do that. I think that was like the biggest takeaway that I had, you know, as far as technology, I barely picked up my phone when I was in St. John's because I just didn't need to. Technology just, it wasn't needed. Yes, like there was TVs on and for like news channels or the Bills game. But other than that, you know, it just like I didn't even feel the need to, oh, like I need to check my phone or I need to go through Instagram or whatnot. And I think that was my biggest takeaway is that everything just kind of slowed down and I just was able to have a conversation because I feel like in this time, not everybody is like ready for a face-to-face conversation. Everything is through each other's phones. And I feel like that we should take a step back from that and actually have a conversation face-to-face with people. So,
well, before we talk to Ken and Tony for some thoughts there, I just want to ask Professor Stites if you want to weigh in on some of the observations you heard. I mean, I suspect this is exactly why this program exists.
I realize I'm sitting here with a big smile on my face because I haven't really had a chance yet to talk to the students after this experience and to hear sort of how it's impacted Sarah and just that thought about slowing down and putting your phone down. it just makes me start to, my brain's just racing. How can we replicate this? How can this happen more where we can gain this perspective of just being able to create these opportunities to just sit and have a conversation and to just feel like you don't need to be connected to a device all the time and to just learn from some really awesome people.
Yeah, I want to think that we can gain that perspective and kind of force ourselves at times to slow down. And yet, Sarah, I was reading this week that Mark Zuckerberg did his first fully virtual reality interview with a writer who was, you know, they used, I don't know, whatever Facebook's new or Meta's new devices are. I confess, I looked at this and I went like, I don't know if I want this. I guess this is coming. I don't know why we're doing this. Sarah, do you have a sense that, you know, technology is sort of inevitable, or you kind of, can we put brakes? And I'm not talking about sort of eliminating, I'm not being totally unrealistic, but can we kind of govern a little bit how much tech in kind of infects what we're doing day to day? Or is that naive?
No, I agree. I think that technology is a huge improvement for everything, you know, in terms of healthcare and yep. communication. I think it's extremely helpful. But I think that there's parts of technology, like different parts of social media, that take away from that in-person interaction and conversation, that face-to-face communication that you used to have to do. You weren't able to just send a text message to someone or call them. You had to actually find a time to meet up with them and actually have a conversation with them, because I just think that it creates a bigger relationship, a stronger connection between people than to just type something over the phone or to just sit by yourself for hours scrolling through Facebook or Instagram or TikTok or whatever all these social media apps are creating. I think that's what we can take a step back from and slow down and kind of just go back to meeting and having coffee with somebody and talking mm-hmm. with them and not just sitting by yourself for an hour going through these apps.
Tony is the vice president of senior housing at St. John's, and I would suspect that Sarah's experience doesn't surprise you.
No, not at all. our residents are very welcoming. And before, you know, when David and I were talking about bringing this program into the Meadows, I know David has been working on this or thinking about this for some years, but we brought it to our residents. We do our weekly coffee hours. We meet with residents weekly, and I brought it to the residents, and not knowing what the reaction would be, the reaction was very excited. They couldn't wait to see the students. They couldn't wait to interact with them, you know, have them in programs, and just seeing how the residents interact with each other, I definitely am not surprised by hearing, you know, her reaction to this.
Ken, what did you think when you heard about this idea?
Well, life is made up of a lot of interracial human experiences. Older teachers with younger students in business and industry, you work with people of many ages. What's unique about the St. John's and the Nazareth College class is the intergenerational experience. Most of our experiences, for example, are parents, children, grandchildren, maybe great-grandchildren, or for the children, uncles, aunts, and cousins. It is very unusual to have a situation where you have 20-year-old students with a prolonged experience 2 hours a week over more than 3 month period with an intimate relationship day after day. And the students are in their 20s, mm-hmm. and the seniors are 50, 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. That's a very unusual interracial experience. And it's of the four or five things that I'm involved with at Brickstone, I consider this the most important thing that I do.
You know, you heard Sarah talking about the value she had in spending this time and a reminder for her to slow down,
disengage from her phone or technology as much as she can realistically. What do you take from these interactions, Ken? What opens up to you?
Well, a very interesting thing happened 8 years ago. I've been attending the class for 2 years, but I was with the same group of three students, Alex Kelly, Sarah Conway, and Aaron States. And I was with this, they were in the same group with me both the fall and the spring semester. And somewhere during that time, Aaron called me up and said, can we have dinner together? And so we found a time, and over the time that they were still in college, there were probably 12 times that we were together. They would come to my house. I would go over to Nazareth College. And I don't think anyone could have foreseen that there would be an ongoing relationship that was going, that would go on. And I'm still in touch with Alex and Sarah and Aaron. And I have a scrapbook. It's about an inch and a half thick of the letters that I've saved and all of the internet things, but it's been and the relationship is as close as it can be to family without being blood relationships.
Great.
And there have been other of the students, because you spend a considerable time together, and I happen to be a retired general surgeon, and relationships need, in a sense, commonality, and all three of these girls and most of the students that in the class are going into occupational therapy, physical therapy, some occasionally going into speech therapy, psychology, nursing. So we have that common interest, and it's been a really rewarding experience.
Ken, what do you make of my father's reaction? My dad likes to joke that if he spends a lot of time with people who are in their 20s, it's like being with a different kind of a creature. He thinks it's like being with a different species. He says the way they communicate and the technology. And do you feel that way, or do you think, look, we can cross this?
Well, the thing that has always impressed me and why I keep coming back is because I realize when I was the age of these students, mm-hmm. the decisions that I was making set the course for the rest of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, my father was a Baptist minister, and all growing up, I wanted to be a Baptist minister. And until I went to college, I was expecting to be a Baptist minister. But I had an interest in art from an early time, and when I got to college, I had to work a science credit. And I said, well, I'll draw my way through vertebrate zoology. And halfway through the semester, the professor asked me into his office and said he knew I was there as a pre-ministerial student, but had I thought of medicine, which I never had.
Wow.
But it's really where I belonged. And that's where I ended up. But at any rate, so it's but I want to tell one other story, if
yeah.
I may, that's not really class-related, but it's related to the three that I still have
sure, yeah.
an ongoing relationship. They were all athletic. Sarah and Alex were soccer players. Aaron was a field hockey
mm-hmm.
player.
Mm-hmm.
And they realized, I think, that as they got old enough, if they got old enough, they weren't going to be able to play those, and knew I was a golfer, and said, we'd like to learn to play golf. So I took them out to, yes, come on, Big Oak.
Yes,
Big
sir.
Oak, and got Rob Kalick, a professor, professional, and he gave them four lessons over time. It was winter, so they couldn't play outdoors, mm-hmm. so it was all indoors. In May of one of the years, the last day of their final exams, they called me and said, "We want to play golf this afternoon." So they'd had four lessons indoors and never hit a ball outdoors. And so we went back to Big Oak and got three sets of golf clubs for the girls and a bag of balls. Went out to the driving range and hit those balls. Then left and went over to Shadow Pines golf course,
yeah.
which has an executive course, mm-hmm. nine holes that are par three. Now, Alex had played some golf with her grandfather, but Sarah and Aaron had never been on a golf course. So we hit a bucket of balls and then went out to Shadow Pines. The first hole is 100 yards. Second hole is 180 yards. Third hole is 130 yards. So they teed their balls up, and Aaron, on the 100-yard first hole, put her ball on the green, never having been on a golf course before. The 180-yard hole was long for one shot for them. We got, on that same first hole, Sarah, who had never been on a golf course before, put her drive in the rough lateral to the green. Mm-hmm. But we got to the 130-yard course hole, and Aaron took another club and put her ball on the green again. And I told him, "Don't you ever forget that the first you were ever on a golf course, the first three holes, you put your ball on the green."
And I bet that they will not forget that. I mean, you obviously have vivid memories of that.
Very much so. And we took the Cubs back to Big Oak, and I told Ron what had happened. He was, of course, very happy, and others of the professionals couldn't believe that in four indoor courses, training, they could do that on a golf course. But,
I bet you they give you a lot of the credit there. You know,
so I still hear from the three of them, and they get in touch from time to time. And I'll say one other thing. I had a slight stroke involving my left foot and left lower leg. Was hospitalized, and they put me on treatment. And then I had some physical therapy, and they recommended physical therapy. And so I asked Dr. Kerper, our family doctor, whether I could be sent to Regain, where Alex worked. So Alex was my physical therapist.
Oh, wow. Wow, amazing. You know, the way Ken has such fond memories of, and it's not just a memory in the past of, an ongoing relationship that has formed, what it tells us that we're going to talk about a little bit in our second half hour is that we can choose to look at, different generations can choose to look at each other as sort of distinct beings with their own customs and norms and not spend a lot of time together, or we can realize that we all really do want the same things, which is to feel connected, to feel part of something, to feel cared about. And that hasn't changed, and that won't change. And we're going to talk a little bit about what the recent data tells us about that. But before we take this only break, let me just ask Professor Stites, you know, when Ken is telling these stories, real relationships are very clear. What do you think those three students gain from that will make them not just better people and better friends, but better at their jobs, better at what they end up doing as a result of this education?
Yeah, I always sort of just joke with my students that, you know, you can't see your client or your patient as a hip replacement. as whatever the diagnosis is. They're a human being. There's a whole person here. And if you slow down a little bit, if you ask just a couple questions and get to know that person a little bit, it's only going to improve potentially their outcomes, the type of treatment you give, the way you give that treatment, and even just your own life.
Let's take this only break. You're hearing Dr. David Stites, who's a professor of psychology and director of Nazareth University's gerontology program. You just heard the wonderful stories and insight from Ken Dodgson, who is a resident at Brickstone. And Sarah Dodona is with us, a senior at Nazareth University. Tony Zaccolino is vice president of senior housing at St. John's. And this is our only break. We're right back with them on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, one of the great Finger Lakes and Rochester musicians is back in our area for a series of concerts. And his life has changed a great deal. Don Potter will talk to us about being an inspiration to the Mangionis and Bat McGrath and the collaborations that he's done over the years and how music has changed and how he has changed. Don Potter, Monday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about intergenerational living and a program that I think Professor Stites, I mean, I'm reading it's the first of its kind in Rochester. Is that right?
In this area, yeah. The idea, I mean, there are programs, I don't know sort of what the status is of them, similar sorts of things. Like there's one in Ohio, for example, an artist in residence program where music students are afforded an opportunity to live in a senior living community, sort of in exchange for giving recitals, concerts to residents. But really what makes this one different for us is that it's students who are going to be working with this population, who I think really can ultimately be better professionals and people by having these shared experiences. It sort of came out of, we honestly had sort of a shame on us moment where we realized we were spending so much time focusing on our student learning outcomes and making sure that students were getting the content that they needed. And there were all of these relationships and those sorts of stories that Ken shared with us that were happening that we just didn't know about. And then, you know, we sort of sat down and thought, well, what can we sort of do to take it to this next level to really create these more meaningful interactions?
Well, you want to add to that? Yeah, go ahead, Ken. Yeah.
Well, to me, it is a gerontology class. So the students are supposed to really learning something about the aging experience. Mm-hmm. And there are assigned readings, but it's not a lecture course. Dr. Stites divides the group up into eight groups of seniors and elders, and they'll take a chapter of the assigned reading and will take some issue of that, and then each group will spend 1 hour just discussing that one thing. And I'm sure the students learn something from reading in the books, but I think what the elders do is just share their personal experience, mm-hmm. or their family experience in whatever that issue was. And I think the students are learning more from just the actual experience of what people go through and how they handle the things that happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, Tony, there's a lot of different ways that students who go through Nazareth University in this program might use their education and might find work. But I wonder if you think this experience will make them better at whatever they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of times there's the ideas of what gerontology is and what it can lead to. And, you know, I think talking with one of the students and talking a lot about, you know, home health aides and nursing homes and things like that, I think, you know, doing this program and staying on site with us at St. John's Meadows, you realize there's a lot of different aspects to what, you know, gerontology can lead to and, you know, the different aspects of it. And, you know, we're working in a community that's senior housing and we work, you know, with our elders and our residents daily and the older population, but it's not in that, you know, nursing home, hospital, care setting. There's, you know, employees that are building services, employees who took a different career path that got to that point. Myself was hospitality and food service before I ended up where I am. And you kind of realize there's different ways to work and, you know, interact with the elders and seniors in the community. And I definitely think from conversations with one of the students, she definitely kind of realized that it's not just home health aides and caregivers and things like that. There's a different side to it as well.
Well, back in May, Connections did a live on the road program. We were out at St. John's and we talked a lot that day about a theme that I want to touch on now, which is that there's really, to me, very interesting and sometimes counterintuitive data about loneliness. Now, the most distressing thing is that all age categories of adults are essentially saying that in the last 10 to 20 years, they are more lonely than they were. The most stable and steady of the group is 65 plus. It's the least lonely group of adults. We also know, to state the obvious, and the experts on the program told us in May, that loneliness can be very dangerous if you are older, if you've lost loved ones, if you're feeling isolated. And so it is sort of its own acute kind of concern, especially depending on where you're living and what the circumstances are. But I was distressed to hear how lonely people feel and how often we hear from, you know, younger adults who go and work in these kinds of programs in these settings. And what they describe is what Sarah's describing, which is, well, I slowed down. I had meaningful conversations. I wasn't on my phone all the time. I felt less stress. And I have to think that that could be connected to loneliness. So, Sarah, if I can ask you, you know, I mean, it's your generation that's listed as the most lonely, and I think technology is often tied to it, which if we were to believe that we are a more connected society, we should be less lonely, but we're becoming more lonely. What do you think, Sarah?
I think I agree that I think my generation is seen as more lonely. Spending my 3 weeks at St. John's, you know, I was able to gain a perspective of like how you go from living in a family and then you move into a home like this and you're able to create this whole new family, you know, with people who aren't blood relatives, but are actually like a family, which give that are there to support you, that take away that loneliness. I think that for us, for our generation, kids who go to college, who are separated from, you know, their homes, I think with technology, it's harder to make friends when you move away from your home and you start a new life at school. For me, I know I went into college during COVID years, so it was definitely a little bit harder for me to make friends. And I felt as if everybody was just kind of separating themselves and staying on their phones or watching TV or just kind of being by themselves because they didn't really, they were nervous. They didn't want to expand and go out and do stuff. But for me, I'm a very outgoing person. I like to go out and socialize and make new friends and talk to different people. So I think that, you know, people who are more nervous and decide that they just want to stay by themselves just increases that loneliness. But if you were to only go out and kind of just let your step out of your comfort zone, that loneliness definitely does go away.
And Sarah, let me read an email from a listener that I think touches on some of this. Preston writes to say, is the experience really slowing down? Or might a more apt description of what you're talking about be to be more fully present when you are with people? And he adds, not all, but so much of social media activity seems to be more akin to superficial distraction as opposed to meaningful engagement. That's Preston. And Sarah, what that recalls for me when I think about that May conversation at St. John's, we were talking to an older woman who told us that she said, look, you may have 1,000 quote unquote friends on Facebook or, you know, various apps, but how many of those are real deep relationships where you could call them if you were hurting or you would expect them to drop things and just get together for an hour or that you could confide in or that you feel truly close to and you've spent extended time in person? And she said that I bet you the answer is a lot smaller. And she said she just thought that was her observation generationally, is that the youngest adults now have a lot of quote unquote connectedness, but not a lot of depth to that connection. And I think Preston is saying we have a habit of being together maybe, but we're not all that present or we're distracted. What do you think, Sarah?
No, I completely agree. I think that, you know, a lot of times, even when you are with a group of people, you're not always paying attention or someone may be talking, but those words may be just kind of going over your head because you have other things going on or you're distracted by something else. I definitely agree with that, which is why I mentioned the whole slowing down while being there in the 3 weeks. And it wasn't slowing down like, you know, everything was slow. It was more like slowing down like I could become present in that moment. I could really get in depth with a conversation and really understand what that person is saying to me and what I'm saying to them.
Yeah, I think that's great. Ken Dodgson wants to weigh in as well. Go ahead, Ken.
I don't have any idea, but I do think that if older people are less lonely, it's because of what happens with people when they leave their individual homes and end up in some sort of senior independent living facility. It's when St. John's Brickstone was first built, and people started moving in. The president at that time, Paul Bartlett, created a coffee hour on Friday morning at 9 o'clock, and he would introduce the people that came in that week, and they had not finished building, and told them what the building problem might be and what the traffic problem could be. That coffee hour is still going. There are in Brickstone somewhere over 100 people, and every Friday coffee hour there'll be 80 or 90 people that come to coffee hour. It has been a real community builder. So I think the fact that you group older people in senior living facilities would be one reason why many relationships develop and why they would be less lonely.
Ken, do you ever feel lonely yourself?
I've never been lonely in my life.
Is that right?
If I have felt it at all after I lost my wife, I read a lot about grieving, and a pastor friend who wrote a book about grieving sent me the book, and so I read it. And I don't know what they're talking about.
You didn't feel
because
grief.
Every time I think of my wife, I have a lot of wonderful memories.
Oh, wow.
Rather than grief. And perhaps the other thing was that after Sally died, I wrote my, it took me a year to write my life story. And it just was a matter of one memory after another. And that's still true. If I think of Sally, some memory comes up of a trip or some experience that we had. And so I don't know what people experience when they either have grieving or loneliness. I can't answer.
To Ken. Did you want to jump in?
I was just going to say that, to Ken's point a bit, in talking about the coffee hours, you know, those groups started at 15 people in one of the living rooms of one of our townhouses and have grown, and just building those connections with the residents and having them come together and introducing, you know, I think to Ken's point of living in a community like Brickstone or St. John's Meadows, we have heard countless times of family members, you know, children of residents talking to us about stopping to see their mom and dad after they moved into the community, after their spouses just passed away. And, where's my mom? Oh, she's over at the musical today, or she's over participating in this program, or went on the lunch trip. And they're like, really? My mom did that? And kind of just watching them build those relationships and kind of have that community, that sense of community, and having somebody versus, you know, still living in their home alone after somebody may have passed away. I definitely think, you know, living in these communities really helps with kind of what Ken's talking about, and kind of just, we literally have groups, resident-run, called connections committees and meetings that build connections and do resident-run programs and meetings with the new residents, and it's been very successful with watching them, you know, blossom their relationships.
Dr. Stites?
And Ken could have chosen, after the passing of Sally, to isolate and to stay in his townhouse, but he chose the very next class to be there and to be present with the students and with his fellow elders and spend that time. So I think, to his point, the choices that you make really, they say a lot about you, and they're very influential in terms of the rest of your life. And that's why my students benefit from these courses. It's from people like Ken who not only say it, but live it and show the benefits of it.
Yeah, and Dr. Stites, to state the obvious, everyone will sort of handle loss and grief in their own way, and I'm sure there is expertise about effective ways to deal with it and maybe less effective ways to deal with it. But I, part of the generational difference that I do wonder about is I think the ubiquitousness of technology and the ability to always be doing something with an app or a phone sometimes allows us not to engage with hard feelings or emotion. And we can be distracted by things and we can run from that in a way. And I have to think that older generations who are maybe didn't grow up with the rhythm of social media and don't desire to be on a phone all the time are maybe better. And I'm just, this is just an observation and I could be off base, but I do wonder if there's maybe a more facility in grappling with emotion or grief or loss or loneliness or potential loneliness more effectively. And I wonder how younger generations are going to do with that as we age. I wonder.
Yeah, one of the many things that I love about the elders of St. John's is just how frank, to the point, straightforward they are. We benefit from that a lot.
Yes.
So I see, to some degree, the benefit in the short term of being able to be distracted by something. Sometimes that is part of that process for individuals.
Mm-hmm.
But I think how you're describing this, it makes a lot of sense in terms of older adults having to rely on one another from a sort of generational, that cohort perspective of being able to lean on each other and have conversations and reach out personally. And to Preston's point, to sort of be present in that moment. When you're on a screen, and Sarah spoke about this, I think, really well in the top of the hour, where all of these different apps that you have, you are not present there. And your point of having multiple Facebook friends, but really what is the depth and level of those connections that you're making? And how do those truly help you through that grieving process or whatever sort of process you're dealing with?
Oh, wow. What a conversation, Sarah. Before we lose it, let me just ask Ken and Sarah a couple of other points there. Ken, do you find yourself interested in understanding and using the technology that a lot of younger adults are using?
Well, I I show my age in terms of being impressed with what young people do with their computers. I have on my computer a whole bunch of what do you call the places where you can plug in?
Oh boy,
The symbols and
tabs, icons.
Icons. And I look at them and I use almost none of them. And I show my age.
Lucky you.
And and I'm impressed with how young people, their smartphones and their computers, they do things that I have no idea what's going on.
But you're impressed, but you're not sort of curmudgeonly about it. I just find it really interesting because I'm kind of curmudgeonly about technology sometimes. Do you also, Ken, find it as you've gotten older, are you more direct with what you need and what you want? And I'm not saying tactless, I'm not saying rude, but do you find yourself more able to just be direct with people about what you think about something, what you need, what you're looking for? Has that changed at all for you?
I don't think it's changed at all. I haven't mentioned that I did want to be a Baptist minister, and before I went to medical school, I came here to Colgate-Rochester Divinity School,
And
I got my degree and I was ordained. So I think even in my medical work, I'm rather pastoral, and
I imagine
I don't know as though that I can answer your question.
Oh, no, you've answered it so well, Ken. I'm so glad you're here, and I'm grateful that you've given us the time. Let me also ask Sarah as we get ready to wrap here. Sarah, you're completing these 3 weeks. I mean, it sounds like it's been an extraordinary experience. Where do you want to be when you're not at NAS, when you think about 3, 5, 10 years in your future? What do you want to be doing, Sarah?
When I think about that in my future, I want to be working in a senior living facility, whether it is independent or whether it is a nursing home. I just know that I want to be working with the geriatric community. So,
you feel ready to do it?
I feel ready. Yes, I do.
Dr. Stites, how many more students get to do this kind of program? What's the timeline?
Well, I'm hoping each semester we'll be able to offer at least to a couple students. We'll see.
Okay. But so far, so good?
So far, so good.
Yeah, really, really remarkable. Tony, as we get ready to wrap here, what do you want to leave with listeners? The Vice President of Senior Housing at St. John's. About 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Just that, from the first 12 hours of the program starting, it was on the Tuesday after the holiday, and up in the student's apartment, just welcoming them, making sure everything's going okay. One of our residents turned the corner, David, and said, "Hey, my new friends, Sarah and Samantha." And right from that moment, I knew this program was going to work out and it was going to be okay. They've been there less than, I think, 24 hours at that point. It's just been really fun. I've been at St. John's for 11 years, going from the dining manager setting up the coffee hours to kind of watch this program grow throughout the years and get it to this point where we've got this new program.
Tony is the Vice President of Senior Housing at St. John's. Thanks for being here on this Friday afternoon. Hey, Sarah Dodona, thank you. Good luck to you. Thanks for sharing your experience with us.
Thank you so much.
To Ken Dodgson, a resident over at Brickstone, and sharing your wonderful experience and wisdom, come back anytime. Thank you for being here, sir.
Thank you for having us.
Appreciate you, and appreciate Dr. David Stites, Professor of Psychology and Director of Nazareth University's Gerontology Program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for the opportunity.
From the whole team at Connections, David, Evan, Megan, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. We're back with you Monday on member-supported public radio.